I'm Kevin Kunzman, Managing Editor of HCP Live. Welcome to Doc Talk. The American Society of Retina Specialists 2020 virtual sessions are live this weekend. The annual conference, like so many before and surely to come after it, is experimenting with remote presentations and online-only discussion in response to the coronavirus pandemic, but it still could not have come at a more ideal time. Ophthalmology is on the precipice of innovation becoming adopted practice, and the meeting's agenda highlights the multitude of means by which retina care is evolving. Few innovations stand out greater than gene therapy, a long-promised and patiently awaited agent that has potential to blow the roof off the limit for treatment benefit for patients suffering from chronic degenerative retina disease. If anti-VEGF agents are defined as the drug class which gave ophthalmologists capability in limiting a disease's burden, gene therapy may be the option that reverses the disease. Among HCP Live's ASRS coverage this weekend is news from Janssen announcing the first data from a trial assessing its investigational gene therapy AAV-RGPR for the treatment of X-linked retinitis pigmentosa, an inherited retinal disease which causes progressive vision loss primarily in boys and young men and could eventually lead to blindness. Though this gene therapy is very early into clinical assessment, it has potential to make history if it moves along the regulatory pipeline. There are currently no FDA-approved therapies for the RPGR gene-mutated disease. This week, I spoke with primary investigator Dr. Michael Michaelides, head of clinical ophthalmology at Myra GTX. Dr. Michaelides and I discussed the early findings for AAV-RGPR, its necessity in the burden patient population, and the overall promise being held by gene therapies in ophthalmology. We hope you enjoy. Dr. Michaelides, I just wanted to lead off, and first and foremost, how are you doing? You're in London right now, right?
Sure, yeah. We're doing okay. Things are definitely improving, and we're slowly getting back to a semblance of normal. It's slow, but we're definitely heading in the right direction. And I think there'll be quite a post-mortem after this is over. I think we could have done better, but
absolutely,
we're doing all right now anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a real learning experience for everyone. And in the meantime, of course, it seems like everyone's done a great job of, tightening up their bootstraps and getting done what needs to be done, particularly with these medical conferences, especially for a field like ophthalmology, which is so well informed by, collaboration and developing research. And we have a really interesting conversation today, I'd say, particularly speaking to RPGR gene therapy. And I don't want to tease it too much, Doctor. If you'd like, can we just get into what exactly the newest data is from the ongoing phase 1 and 2 trial?
Sure. Yeah. So what we presented at ASRS is data from our dose escalation portion of our ongoing phase 1/2 trial of AAV5 treatment for X-linked RP caused by disease-causing variants in RPGR. And so we presented 6-month outcome from that dose escalation. There were 10 patients in that phase, 3 in the low dose, 4 in the intermediate dose, and 3 in the high dose. So in terms of being a phase 1/2, the main outcome is, of course, safety. And so what we found in our dose escalation phase was that it was generally well tolerated and had an ocular and systemic safety profile that was anticipated and was manageable. We didn't observe any unexpected safety concerns. There were no subjects that discontinued the course of the study from dose escalation, and there were no dose-limiting events. About half of the adverse events that occurred were ocular in nature, and most were considered to be associated with actually the delivery procedure for the surgery.
Right.
They were transient and resolved without intervention. Mm-hmm. And in our high-dose cohort, as we and others have seen in their gene therapy trials for retinal disease, mm-hmm. we saw inflammation in 2 out of 3 of the participants at that high-dose cohort that very likely mitigated the potential for treatment benefit in those subjects. Right. And so that particular dose hasn't been taken forward either into our dose confirmation phase, mm-hmm. Where we injected 3 children with the intermediate dose, and nor has it been continued into our randomized controlled dose escalation, dose expansion phase.
Right.
Should I keep on going, or did you
want to
chip in?
Well, actually, I was curious, Doc, if we could take a beat to talk a little bit more about the XLRP patient population. What exactly are we looking at in terms of, you know, its reach, and particularly speaking to the burdens that these patients face? Obviously, they have no currently approved therapies, and, you know, these findings are very beneficial for that. But speaking very intimately to the individual patient, what exactly are they going through?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So these are patients. So they're men. This is being X-linked. It predominantly affects boys and men. Infrequently, it can actually affect the female carriers, and sometimes as severely as the male patients with RP. In fact, so how these patients first become affected is in early childhood. They become aware of difficulty seeing in low levels of illumination in the dark, and that gets worse year upon year. They also start to become aware in childhood of narrowing of their peripheral vision, their side vision, so that results in them in tripping and bumping over things, and often, in fact, children are referred to as being clumsy before they actually receive a diagnosis of RP.
Wow.
And then as that progresses into their adulthood, they obviously find that difficulty seeing in dim illumination and narrow peripheral vision has social, you know, emotional and impacts on daily activities. So if they're going out in the evening to socialize, they often need to be led around by their friends. If someone puts out a hand to shake their hand, they'll often not see that because it will be in their blind area, as it were. And
yeah.
So that's obviously very uncomfortable and awkward. Throughout adult life into their 30s and early 40s, that peripheral visual field loss continues to get ever more profound and starts to affect central vision. And they start to develop what often is referred to as tunnel vision. So looking through a narrow field in the center, and eventually that is extinguished, and they lose that central vision in their late 30s, early 40s. So it's always progressive. It's one of the more rapidly progressive forms of RP, and it's certainly the most common cause of X-linked RP.
Yeah.
And as you know, RP being by far the commonest genetic cause of blindness, affecting about 1 in 3,000 individuals.
Wow. Wow, and what exactly I'm imagining in terms of going through this is a huge burden, as you're alluding to, and all these situations of...
No, absolutely. So these are children who are significant. So patients that are affected really from early childhood. So they start to have significant difficulties at school, going out on field trips, and that does affect how they interact and how they develop. But I guess they start to have the most profound effects in early adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
As these young men start to wish to become more independent, start to take roles in the workplace, and increasingly go out to socialize. So that's when it has its most profound effect.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, also that has emotional and psychological impact. So it's a disease that has dramatic impacts on the lives of these young men.
Yeah.
And you see how it affects their relationships, their employment prospects, and their activities of daily living, as they need to have more and more support and greater degrees of lose greater degrees of independence.
I can imagine it being just certainly burdensome. And in any instance where, you know, my first thought goes to something like Alzheimer's, which, you know, has a delayed diagnosis because, you know, the symptoms that present initially are kind of chalked up to something beyond the reach of a more severe issue. And of course,
sure.
With this...
No, I think that's absolutely right, yeah. I mean, especially, I think that's especially right for the children because, you know, you hear often... parents and the children themselves will say, well, it's dark, it's hard to see, isn't it? I mean, everyone finds it hard to see in the dark, don't they? But actually, everyone doesn't. They adapt very rapidly, and they can get around in the dark, whereas these individuals, you know, really cannot function. They need to be led. The lights have to be switched on.
Yeah.
And again, as I sort of alluded to earlier, this sort of nature of clumsiness. Well, you know, lots of little boys are clumsy, aren't they? They're busy running around. So you're right. Those two factors certainly can result in a delay of diagnosis in the children.
Mm-hmm.
Less so in the young adults, but they tend to have changes at the back of the eye, in the retina. There are sort of obvious retinal changes. But certainly in families that aren't aware of there being X-linked RP in the family, that there can be delay in those children. So that does really often come as quite a shock to the families, actually. In the past, I've found children are really relatively resilient and sort of tend to adapt, but it's quite an impact on the families and their carers, and we often forget the impact on the wider family as well as the patient.
And certainly, Doctor, with that being so prevalent, and obviously that affecting some measure of, time to diagnosis and screening efforts, of course, for it, I imagine it puts a double stress on the fact that there are no available therapies, and whatever is available needs to be very efficacious, very safe, and able to address it in a timelier fashion. Can we talk a little bit about, gene therapy's evolving role as we understand it beyond just this data in this patient population?
Sure. I mean, the promise of gene therapy has obviously been made for quite some time now, but it's really starting to deliver. So genuinely, I think we are in new times. It's a new era. There's, of course, an approved therapy for a very early onset form of RP, if you like. So RP65 retinal dystrophy could be considered an early onset form of retinitis pigmentosa, and clearly that's having, you know, very positive impacts on patients and their families. So in terms of the X-linked RP caused by RPGR space, for patients it's almost unbelievable where we are. Certainly as an inherited retinal disease specialist, I would not have predicted, you know, 5 years ago that there would be three gene therapy trials exploring therapy for X-linked RP caused by RPGR. So for patients, it's absolutely fantastic. And in terms of their engagement with our trials and our natural history studies, it's really superb. They're very, very generous with their time and hugely enthusiastic and motivated to take part. And the data from these studies is, as I say, is very promising. We need longer timelines, we need phase 3 trials, but certainly the study that I presented, sponsored by MIRA GTX, is progressing really very well, and we're looking forward to taking it on to further phases of intervention.
That's excellent. And focus more directly now on these findings and the follow-up data, as you alluded to, necessary for the program to progress to phase 3 and for us to better interpret exactly the gene therapy's role in this patient population. What are some more specific parameters do you imagine we're going to be looking for?
Sure. So in addition to that durability and having the sort of the randomized controlled element that is, of course, very important to obtain the most robust, reliable, impactful data. The sorts of endpoints that I think are particularly important to patients, and of course that should be all that really matters, is what matters to patients, is being able to have a positive impact on central function, central vision. I would put that as a number one. Certainly, whilst patients do have difficulties functioning when night vision is challenging or their peripheral vision is compromised, they still manage, but they're far more compromised when their central visual function starts to be affected. And so that's why I place that having a positive impact on central vision as the number one. And so all the measures of central retinal sensitivity, I think, are paramount and should be prioritized. And certainly in the dose escalation phase that we've presented, We've got some very robust data from the low and intermediate dose cohorts of the dose escalation, showing improvements in retinal sensitivity or stabilization, either on Octopus 900 full field static perimetry or mesopic Maya microperimetry. So I think it's important it's on two different devices, which have their strengths and weaknesses, and also the fact that when you look at retinal sensitivity data from either of the two modalities, using three different analysis approaches, be it a conventional mean sensitivity, so just simply the average of those data points, or more advanced modeling to derive a Hiller vision, a volumetric assessment of the retinal sensitivity. And finally, if you do a point-wise, a point-by-point comparison of individual points over time, be it with those three analyses or the two modalities, we see a very, very clinically meaningful improvement or stabilization of retinal sensitivity in the majority of patients in those two cohorts. So that's really very, very promising, encouraging, and you know, we look forward to sharing data showing its durability and then seeing how these patients respond in the randomized controlled expansion phase. I think after retinal sensitivity and central vision, just one final point. I think the second aspect of vision that I think would be very meaningful for patients would be to actually then have an impact on their navigation in dim illumination. And so some of the measures we've seen in other trials looking at mobility performance, how patients navigate in different lighting levels, I think will also be very important to demonstrate improvements in and will be very gratefully received by patients.
That's excellent. Thank you so much for that, Dr. McLeodies. And speaking, you know, once more and sort of lastly on the broad promise of gene therapy, I think, of course, when we're talking about this is the progression from preserving patient status to improving it. And that's, I think, the great promise of gene therapy in ophthalmologic conditions in general right now, right, is that we're looking at this as something that instead of curbing a chronic condition, actually it combats it and reduces and can reverse the effect. And I wanted to see if you had thoughts on, of course, broadly speaking, the potential of gene therapy in the shortcoming years of ophthalmology.
Sure, absolutely. You know, you've hit the nail on the head, as we say here. So absolutely spot on. That's it's a conversation I was having with patients yesterday. So you're absolutely right. It was not that long ago that the best we might have hoped for and would be thought was realistic biologically was to at least slow progression. It seemed almost inconceivable to halt progression and even more inconceivable to improve vision. But I believe you're absolutely right. We've moved into a time where we and then patients are actually hoping for improvements, and certainly that is what we are seeing with multiple different inherited retinal disease now, some of the gene therapy data that's coming out. So I think it's absolutely right to be anticipating or expecting improvements in visual function. But in addition, one might hope that by restoring function and one anticipates structure, that you will have a positive impact on progression as well. And certainly we have some early indications in the data we've presented from our dose escalation phase that we may well be having an effect on slowing functional deterioration. So hopefully patients can have their cake and eat it.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. That's certainly great. And just anything else you want to add, Dr. McLeodies, regarding this data, regarding gene therapy, regarding this patient population, or just even ASRS this year?
You know, I commend ASRS for what they're doing. It's been incredibly professional, and you know, it's great to see that everyone's just pulling together and still being able to share important data for all of us to, you know, strengthen our understanding and our collaborations and hopefully deliver better treatments for our patients. So that's huge, and it's felt even more in these difficult times. And I guess I am very, very optimistic about the promise of gene therapy, and And as I tell my patients, I do believe we'll have approved therapies that will be coming on stream year upon year. So I've gone from cautiously optimistic to optimistic.
That's great. That's a great sentiment to end on. I'd say I'd take that progress from cautiously to just overall optimistic. So thank you so much for your time, Dr. Michaelides, and appreciate your insight on this.
No, that was a great pleasure. Hope that helps, and come back if you need any more.
Will do. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Dr. Michaelides for his time and insight. And for more ASRS 2020 coverage, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com. For now, I'm Kevin Kunzman. Thanks for listening to Doc Talk.